is put on notice. The 39-year-old director has been waiting at home in Washington with his mother for word from Chicago. It is Agent Purvis who delivers the news, calling from the telephone in the theater office. "We got him," says Purvis. "Dead or alive?" asks Hoover. "Dead." Hoover races to the Justice Department. There, he holds a midnight press conference to announce the shooting. "The only good criminal," Hoover says, "is a dead criminal." The director expresses no remorse to the media about his agents shooting first. Meanwhile, at the Cook County Morgue on West Polk Street in Chicago, every politician and his friend in Chicago crowded into the morgue for the morbid purpose of viewing John Dillinger's remains, in the words of an official DOI report. In the midst of this chaos, a young chemist from a local embalming college convinces authorities to allow him to place wet plaster over Dillinger's face to mold a death mask. As a sign of his victory over John Dillinger, a moment some still consider the greatest day in Division of Investigation history, J. Edgar Hoover will place this mask on display outside his office, where it will remain for decades to come. So it is that John Dillinger is dead at age 31. His criminal career lasted more than a decade, but it is the last year of his life for which the bank robber is infamous. In the period from September 1933 to his death in July 1934, the Dillinger gang killed 10 men, wounded 7 more, staged 3 jailbreaks, and robbed 11 banks of more than $300,000. Footnote: roughly $5.7 million in modern currency. End footnote. Years from now, when J. Edgar Hoover is asked about his greatest thrill as a crime fighter, the answer will come immediately: the night we got Dillinger. In the dramatic midnight press conference, Hoover seizes a moment to shift America's eyes away from the deceased Dillinger. He promises reporters that he will soon name a new public enemy number one. The next day, Charles Arthur Pretty Boy Floyd receives that designation. A bounty of $23,000 is placed on Floyd's handsome, well-coiffed head. The new number one is already a legend in the bank-robbing world. Bonnie and Clyde were so enamored of his skills that they once contacted him about joining forces, a request Floyd rejected, considering the young lovers to be more trouble than he could handle. Floyd is a 30-year-old Georgia native who moved to Oklahoma at the age of 7. He is divorced from his wife Ruby and never sees his 9-year-old son Dempsey, named for the legendary prize fighter Jack, whom Floyd idolizes. In addition to bank jobs, Floyd is thought to be responsible for almost a dozen murders, including the notorious Kansas City Massacre, where 4 law enforcement officers were shot to death. Floyd is also suspected of being part of John Dillinger's gang for his final robbery, that of the Merchants National Bank in South Bend. Floyd has not been seen publicly since that heist. Although Charlie Floyd is a media hero to some, he is actually a hardened criminal. He carries automatic weapons wherever he goes and thinks nothing of opening fire on any man or woman who crosses him. Agent Melvin Purvis is not directing the search for Pretty Boy. He has violated the Division of Investigation's number one rule. Director Hoover bristles as Purvis receives public accolades and celebrity for the Dillinger takedown. Hoover is publicly unwilling to state which agents killed the fugitive, not wanting the press and public to know he had hired a posse of violent men to do the division's dirty work. And though Purvis never claims to have fired a single round on the night of Dillinger's death, the absence of information about who actually pulled the trigger has led the press to make a hero of Melvin Purvis, giving him credit for the bank robber's demise. Hoover responds by nitpicking the agent's behavior, demanding a strict accounting of Purvis's time and activities. The chasm between director and special agent grows day by day. On September 6, 1934, just 6 weeks after Melvin Purvis oversees the most successful event in DOI history, he is officially demoted. Sam Cowley, the jowly bureaucrat who attended the same law school as Hoover, now takes charge of the Chicago Bureau. A humiliated Purvis retains his job and office, but is forbidden from venturing out into the streets to investigate leads. The agent is devastated by the demotion. Single and childless, Purvis lives for the division. But mundane paperwork now occupies his office hours, even as Cowley turns the screws on Chicago's DOI agents, desperate to fulfill Hoover's order that Pretty Boy Floyd be captured within the next 30 to 45 days. Melvin Purvis drinks to console himself, though in secret, knowing J. Edgar Hoover would not approve. To his friends, Pretty Boy Floyd is called Chalk, after a brand of beer known as Choctaw. The legend of his more famous nickname is unclear. Some say it was an old girlfriend who called him Pretty Boy, while others claim the name came from a prostitute. But the career criminal hates the Pretty Boy moniker. He prefers to go by Charlie. Floyd comes from a long line of dirt-poor sharecroppers who farm cotton on rented land. Though his father eventually runs a small grocery store, Floyd grows up in poverty, living with his parents in what is known as a boxcar house, a low, flat building with a tar paper roof. There are just two rooms, a kitchen and bedroom. Newspapers are glued over cracks in the walls to keep out the wind. There is no heat or running water. The Floyds are a religious family, active in the Hanson Baptist Church. But upon leaving school after the sixth grade, young Charlie begins working the harvests in Kansas and Oklahoma. There, he falls in with a tough crowd, becoming known for brawling, drinking, and chasing girls. At age 20, he tries his hand at farming after getting married to 17-year-old Ruby Hardgraves, but soon grows bored. 1 year later, in 1925, Charlie Floyd commits his first robbery, a Kroger grocery store. Floyd is soon arrested and sent to the Missouri State Penitentiary, where he serves 4 years, enduring an incarceration of floggings and brutal 12-hour workdays. Ruby divorces him before his release in 1929. But even after getting out of the penitentiary, Floyd is not really a free man. He takes up residence in Kansas City, where local police regularly arrest him for crimes he does not commit, knowing he is an ex-convict. Finally, in November 1929, 8 months after earning his freedom, the man now nicknamed Pretty Boy learns that his father has been gunned down in the grocery store. Walter Floyd was tough and sometimes overbearing, but his son deeply respects his father. When Walter's killer is exonerated on charges of self-defense, Pretty Boy's immersion into the criminal world becomes complete. His father's assailant soon vanishes, never to be seen again. Pretty Boy Floyd has taken his revenge. He will kill 9 more times over the course of his life. Using a blade, he will carve a notch into his pocket watch for each murder. As the summer of 1934 turns to autumn, the post-Dillinger hunt for other top bank robbers becomes intense. In addition to public enemy number one, Floyd, police and DOI agents across the nation are looking for criminals like Babyface Nelson and the equally notorious Carpus Barker gang. Robbing banks has been a part of the national culture for 100 years, a get-rich-quick crime with its own unique romance originating during the nation's Western expansion. But the publicity and glory of bank robbing has never been so great as it is now. The Great Depression, which began in 1929, has embittered millions of Americans to the financial industry. Banks foreclose on desperate farmers and workers. The poor have no power, and the financiers have a lot of power. bank robbers and other grifters become accepted avengers. Pretty Boy Floyd has even been nicknamed the Sagebrush Robin Hood for his prairie roots and has inspired devotion throughout the Midwest for his habit of buying groceries for poor families and tearing up mortgages in the course of robberies. Floyd is renowned for being courteous and impeccably groomed during those stickups. He never wears a mask to conceal his identity. His four front teeth are capped in gold, and he flashes a tattoo of a rose on his left forearm. Such is Floyd's popularity in rural areas that total strangers often prepare him meals and hide him from the authorities. In return, he always leaves money as a way of saying thanks. Charlie Floyd's former wife and son are even capitalizing on the bank robber's notoriety, earning their living by performing a stage show titled Crime Doesn't Pay. Yet, crime does pay. America's most wanted criminals are flush with cash and spend it easily, often paying for purchases with thick rolls of bills from their armed heists. But the robbers are hardly carefree. Now that Hoover and his federal agents have nationwide control of the manhunt, the robbers feel pressure no matter where they go. Babyface Nelson is currently camping in Nevada and California, unable to stay in a proper hotel because his face is so well known. Compatriots in the underworld who once sheltered Nelson now refuse to hide him, describing his current state as too hot. Pretty Boy Floyd is in a similar fix. Like John Dillinger before him, Charlie Floyd is rumored to be everywhere at once. Some say he's in Mexico, while others even insist he has joined the Chinese army. In reality, Floyd's cut from the South Bend robbery is running out, and he can almost feel the federal noose tightening. He is hiding in Buffalo, New York, but after Dillinger's death, Floyd decides the time has come to return home to Oklahoma. En route, on October 19, 1934, Charlie Floyd and two other men robbed the People's Bank in Tiltonsville, Ohio. The take is a paltry $500. A four-year-old girl bursts into tears during the robbery. "Don't cry, little girl," Floyd soothes her. "We ain't going to hurt you." The child's terrified mother holds out the small deposit of $3 she is about to make. Floyd refuses to take the money. The subsequent getaway is unremarkable. By nightfall, Floyd is 40 miles away. But the following morning, a Saturday, just outside the Ohio town of Wellsville, Pretty Boy Floyd loses control of his Ford sedan on a rain-slicked road. The car slides into a telephone pole. Floyd is traveling with a partner in crime, Adam Ricchetti, along with their girlfriends, Beulah and Rose Baird. As always, Floyd is armed with a machine gun. Believing that two sisters would be less conspicuous than two men, Floyd instructs the ladies to drive into town and have the car repaired. Floyd and Ricchetti will hide on a nearby hillside until they return. The breakdown was an ominous reminder of past events for Floyd. 1 year ago, while driving through Missouri with Ricchetti, their vehicle suffered mechanical issues. Upon taking the car to a local shop for repairs, the pair are surprised to see the local sheriff walk into the garage. Immediately, Floyd and Ricchetti kidnap the lawman at gunpoint, steal a vehicle from the garage, and drive him 50 miles north before setting the sheriff free. Floyd and Ricchetti escape into Kansas, arriving in Kansas City at 10 p.m. Floyd has previously spent a great deal of time there and has a number of contacts. The two criminals choose to hide out in the home of an assassin named Vernon Miller, a South Dakota native and World War I Army veteran whose wartime specialty was operating a machine gun. By sheer coincidence, Miller has been contracted by a Chicago crime syndicate to commit a murder the following day. He tells his house guests of an elaborate plan to free a career criminal named Frank Nash from federal custody. Nash, who recently escaped from the Leavenworth Penitentiary in Kansas, has been recaptured and is being escorted by two Division of Investigation agents back to Leavenworth. Miller's job is to intercept the agents as they alight from a morning train. But a solo job is risky. Prior to the arrival of Floyd and Ricchetti, Miller has spent hours trying to recruit cohorts. He has been unsuccessful. But Floyd and Ricchetti instantly agree to help him. On the morning of June 17, 1933, Miller, Floyd, and Ricchetti drive to the Kansas City's Union Railway Station in a stolen Chevrolet. They observe federal agents and police officers armed with shotguns waiting for the train. It is shortly after agents escort Frank Nash off the train that a gunfight begins. The shooting lasts only 30 seconds. When it is over, three Kansas City policemen and federal agent R.J. Caffrey lie dead. The three gunmen then rush to free Nash, who has also been shot. "They're all dead. Let's get out of here," one of the shooters yells, leaving Frank Nash to bleed out in the street. The killers are not followed as their Chevrolet speeds from the station. Floyd and Ricchetti conceal themselves so expertly during the shooting that it will be many months before federal agents can place them at what will be labeled the Kansas City Massacre. The same, however, cannot be said of Vernon Miller, though it is not the federal government that will bring him to justice. The assassin's failure to successfully extricate Frank Nash alive will prove very unpopular in Chicago. 5 months after the massacre, Miller's strangled body is found in a roadside ditch, his head caved in after repeated blows from a claw hammer. With Kansas City still fresh on his mind, Pretty Boy Floyd knows he cannot risk another encounter with the law. Thus, he sends Beulah and Rose Baird into Wellsville to get their car fixed. And so begin the last 48 hours of Charlie Floyd's short life. He and his accomplice are soon spied by locals, who report the presence of suspicious men to local law enforcement. Ricchetti is quickly arrested. He is just 24 and will soon be executed in the Missouri State Penitentiary gas chamber for his role in the Kansas City massacre. But Pretty Boy Floyd will never go back to jail. He escapes into nearby woods, where he lives off the land for 2 days. Finally, starving and exhausted, he knocks on a farmhouse door and asks for a plate of food. The time is just past noon on October 22, 1934. Unbeknownst to Floyd, the Division of Investigation is on his tail. Floyd's movements have been cited by several eyewitnesses. By 4:25 p.m., two Chevrolets loaded with DOI agents and local police are blocking the driveway to the farmhouse where Floyd has just finished his last supper of spare ribs, bread, and pumpkin pie. Leading the agents is none other than Melvin Purvis, sent to Ohio by J. Edgar Hoover as a chance for redemption. As the team of agents prepare to open fire, Floyd runs and takes cover behind a corn crib. It is Purvis who gives the kill order. "Let him have it." Purvis fires his service revolver 6 times, but does not hit Charlie Floyd, who begins sprinting across a field of clover to the safety of dense woods. All told, more than 100 other shots are fired simultaneously by the agents and police: pistols, Winchester rifles, and machine guns. 3 bullets do strike Pretty Boy Floyd. His gun hand can no longer function due to a round shattering his right arm. 2 other bullets tear through his torso, breaking Floyd's ribs, severing major arteries, and destroying his stomach, small intestine, right kidney, and pancreas. Pretty Boy Floyd falls to the ground, 1 pistol in his waistband and another clutched in his useless right hand. He is dying. Special Agent Purvis walks across the field and leans over the bank robber. "You are Pretty Boy Floyd," he says, seeking confirmation. "I'm Charles Arthur Floyd." Moments later, Floyd breathes his last. Footnote. In September 1979, Captain Chester Smith of the East Liverpool Police Department came forth with a different version of the events surrounding the death of pretty boy Floyd. Smith, who was present at the time of Floyd's arrest, claimed in Time magazine that Purvis ordered fellow agent Herman Hollis to fire a machine gun burst into Floyd, who had already been captured and disarmed. The FBI disavows this claim. End footnote. A pleased J. Edgar Hoover immediately names a new public enemy number one. Even as more than 20,000 people from an estimated 20 states travel to Oklahoma for the funeral of pretty boy Floyd, the director tells the world about yet another notorious murderer and bank robber. "He's a crazy killer," says Hoover, "a vicious half-pint yellow killer who shoots without provocation." Indeed, the handsome young man nicknamed Babyface Nelson is a psychopath, but also a poor shot, which is a bad combination for any man wielding a machine gun. Born Lester Joseph Gillis, the career criminal was raised in Chicago, the seventh son of Belgian immigrant parents. His mother Marie dotes on her youngest boy, even claiming that the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Lester is the most attractive of her children. The family lives in an area of southwest Chicago known as the Patch, populated almost entirely by first-generation immigrants. From an early age, the future killer shows enormous compassion for animals, often bringing home stray dogs and kittens. Much to the chagrin of his mother, a former teacher, Lester also develops an aversion to school, preferring to walk the streets instead of attending class. Since the end of the American Civil War in 1865, two distinct cultures have developed in Chicago. The first is the Union Stockyards, 475 acres of cattle, hogs, and sheep destined to be slaughtered, butchered, and shipped all around the country. No place in the world processes more meat than Chicago. The brutal manual labor of slaughterhouses and stockyards is the only employment open to many immigrants. Lester's father tans cowhides for a living, enduring sweltering temperatures in the summer, sub-zero gales in the winter, and the pungent smells of animal waste and rotting carcasses all year round. This is the life awaiting young Lester Gillis. The other culture that has come to define Chicago is the criminal gang. These gangs comprise mainly immigrant men who choose to live a life of crime, believing that being murdered or imprisoned is preferable to a life in the packing houses. Many gangs are divided along ethnic lines, particularly between the Italians and Irish. Their specialties include extortion, bootlegging alcohol, and car theft. The gangs also play a major role in Chicago society. Local politicians and business owners secretly hire young hoodlums to terrorize their rivals. This relationship between the criminal world and Chicago's wealthy elite is gaining the city a reputation for widespread corruption, which will endure for decades. For young Lester Gillis, so fond of skipping school and wandering through Chicago, it is only a matter of time before he falls in with the criminal element. His first arrest is a complete accident. The date is July 4, 1921. Lester and a friend come across a revolver belonging to the other boy's father. Thinking it will be fun to shoot a gun on the 4th of July, they take the pistol to an alley where Lester's shot ricochets, hitting a nearby child in the jaw. Though the boy survives, 12-year-old Lester Gillis is sentenced to 1 year in the Cook County School for Boys. Soon after his release, Lester is sentenced to 18 months in the Illinois State School for Boys after stealing a car. He is later returned to the same institution for a second auto theft, then a third. His beleaguered father commits suicide during this time, leaving Lester's mother penniless. A devoted son, Lester promises to support his mother upon his release from prison. For a short time, Lester keeps his promise. He marries a store clerk named Helen Wozniak, takes care of his mother, and keeps his criminal behavior to a minimum. Lester likes cars and works at a standard oil station. He and Helen have a son, Ronald. But when Helen becomes pregnant for a second time, a strapped Lester Gillis, believing the only way to make ends meet is a return to his criminal past, forms a gang. Between January 6th and November 23rd, 1930, Lester Gillis breaks into the homes of two prominent Chicago families, stealing $300,000 in jewelry, $5,600,000 in modern currency. He also robs the Itasca State Bank, kills his first man when he fatally shoots a Chicago stockbroker during a botched robbery, and takes part in a gun battle outside an Illinois roadhouse, resulting in the deaths of three patrons. Lester's handsome personal appearance and short stature are easily remembered by eyewitnesses. "He had a baby face," one woman will recall. "Good-looking, hardly more than a boy." Lester Gillis had previously used the last name Nelson as one of many aliases. Thus, Babyface Nelson is born. 1 year later, in 1931, police arrest Nelson and his gang. He is sentenced to a term of 1 to 10 years in the Illinois State Penitentiary at Joliet. While in prison, Nelson is charged with another crime and must travel to Wheaton, Illinois to stand trial. There, he receives a term of 1 year to life. Helen is in the courtroom to witness the verdict. So it is, at just 23 years old, that Babyface Nelson's criminal career seems to be over. The date is February 17, 1933. He is allowed to say goodbye in the courtroom to Helen, who then follows her husband and his guard to the Wheaton train depot to see him off. Babyface looks anything but tough, shivering as light snow flurries buffet the depot on a cold gray Wednesday. He wears leg irons and his right wrist is handcuffed to prison guard R.N. Martin. For good measure, deputies frisk the prisoner before he is bundled aboard the train back to Joliet. Helen watches the train leave the station. To this day, it is not known how she smuggled a gun to her husband. Some believe she hid it in a train station restroom where Lester was allowed to go unshackled. Others speculate that perhaps Babyface's sister Leona, who had also come to watch the trial, had delivered the weapon. What is known is that upon arriving in Joliet, guard R.N. Martin hails a cab to drive Babyface Nelson back to the penitentiary. The two men get into the back seat. The ride begins quietly, with Babyface staring out the window in deep thought. Suddenly, as the car comes within sight of the prison's enormous stone walls, Babyface Nelson pokes a pistol in Martin's ribs. "Don't give me a reason to kill you," he tells the guard. Forcing Martin to unlock his shackles, Babyface orders the driver to continue driving straight past the prison gates and back to Chicago. 4 miles outside the town of Cicero, Babyface directs driver Joe Kandick to pull off onto a side road. After stealing $10 from Martin's wallet, Nelson lets his prisoners go outside the Resurrection Cemetery. Then he drives to Chicago, a free man. The 23-year-old is now a national fugitive, one of the most hunted criminals in America. And Babyface Nelson could not be happier. He likes the action. Nelson spends the next 2 years driving back and forth across the country. Sometimes he travels with Helen and his two children, but other times they stay with family. Nelson's habit is to hide for a time in the growing cities of San Francisco and Reno, where he is less known. When he needs money, he drives back to the Midwest to rob a bank. But Babyface Nelson is becoming more erratic, fond of squeezing off machine gun bursts as he flees, unconcerned about striking innocent bystanders. Yet, compared to John Dillinger, Babyface is still a small-time hoodlum. On December 28, 1933, when the state of Illinois issues its list of most wanted criminals, Dillinger is at the top and Nelson at the bottom, ranked number 21. In March 1934, word reaches Babyface through mutual friends that the infamous Dillinger would like his assistance. Though the two men have never met, associates of Dillinger ask him to help fund the bribes that will make the bank robber's escape from the Crown Point County Jail a reality. A strapped Dillinger promises to pay back Nelson through the proceeds of future heists. Thus, both are present at Little Bohemia when federal agents surround the travel lodge in April 1934. Helen is arrested and taken into custody on that night. Babyface, making his escape, confronts and kills DOI Special Agent W. Carter Baum at point-blank range. In time, Babyface Nelson will kill more federal agents than any other public enemy number one, a total of three. The murder of Agent Baum elevates Nelson's profile within the division and the criminal underworld. He befriends not only John Dillinger, but also Pretty Boy Floyd and another highly wanted felon named Alvin Karpis, thus becoming the common thread among the four men who will all eventually be named Public Enemy Number One. On June 30, 1934, Babyface works with Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd to rob the Merchants National Bank in South Bend, Indiana. The action publicly humiliates the Division of Investigation by showing that the three most wanted men in America can rob banks at will. Yet South Bend is also nearly a catastrophe. While Dillinger, Floyd, and the rest of the gang work smoothly and professionally, executing a carefully prepared plan, Babyface appears rattled and anxious. He is nearly killed, shot in the chest by a local jeweler. Amazingly, an iron vest stops the bullet, saving Nelson's life. He looses a burst from his machine gun in retaliation, missing the jeweler but wounding a bystander. Then, as the gang races from the bank toward their waiting getaway car, a local teenager leaps on Nelson's back and tries to tackle him. The tussle ends when Nelson brings the butt of his gun down hard on the boy's head. In the end, Nelson escapes. He then drives across the country and disappears into the anonymity of the American West. Helen, recently paroled after her Little Bohemia conviction, joins him. The couple take care not to commit crimes that might give them away. Incredibly, Babyface and Helen are taken into custody by small-town police in Utah for speeding. But, after paying a $5 fine, Nelson is let go. His car, filled with its usual cargo of machine guns and ammunition, is not searched. Babyface Nelson knows he is lucky. But that luck will soon run out. John Dillinger is dead, shot by federal agents in Chicago on July 22, 1934. Pretty Boy Floyd is dead, shot by federal agents outside Chicago on October 22, 1934. 2 days later, Babyface Nelson decides to drive from Nevada to Chicago. Money is running low, and he hears rumors that DOI agents have been searching local campgrounds, knowing that is his preferred hideout. On Monday, November 26th, Babyface and Helen drive into Chicago with a criminal named John Paul Chase. Helen is dropped on the north side to see a movie. Nelson then steals a brand new Ford V8. That night, Babyface and Helen sleep in the car, but the cold weather makes it obvious that they need to move indoors. Babyface knows of a resort just above the Illinois-Wisconsin border called the Lake Como Inn. He stayed there before and is confident that once the hotel closes for the winter, they can hide there without fear of discovery. On the morning of November 27th, Babyface and Helen drive north from Chicago in the stolen Ford. John Paul Chase rides with them. At 2 p.m., the three arrive at the home of Hobart Hermanson, owner of the Lake Como Inn. Hermanson is a former bootlegger with connections to the Chicago underworld and can be depended upon to remain silent about suspicious guests, or so Nelson thinks. Babyface pulls into the driveway and notices a young man squinting at the car. The bank robber doesn't recognize the man, which he finds odd, having spent considerable time at the inn and getting to know the staff. Without shutting off the engine, Babyface rolls down the window and makes pleasantries, inquiring about Hermanson. The scene is calm, and the man on the porch has no clue that the legendary Babyface Nelson is clutching a .38 caliber pistol ready to shoot him dead should anything go wrong. After being told that Hermanson is on vacation, Babyface backs out and drives away. Much to Helen's surprise, he is in a panic. "That was a G-man," says Babyface, using underworld terminology for government agents. "And we caught him with his pants down." That's Babyface Nelson, Special Agent James Metcalf anxiously tells himself. Metcalf, a veteran of the Dillinger Squad, has been on a stakeout in the home of Hobart Hermanson for 3 weeks. Two other agents are also living in the house, tipped off that Nelson planned to spend the winter there. By a stroke of luck, they captured the girlfriend of John Paul Chase in San Francisco, who gave them explicit details about the Lake Como Inn and Nelson's plans. Hermanson was then questioned about Nelson's previous visit. He feigned surprise at the true identity of his former guest, but offered to help the Division of Investigation in any way possible. Thus, three DOI agents moved into Hermanson's home. It is 2:30 p.m. when Agent Metcalf uses a local payphone to call the Chicago office. Sam Cowley takes the call. Preparing to leave immediately for Lake Como, he stops in the office of Agent Purvis to tell him of the Babyface sighting. "Let's get going," says Purvis. But Cowley reminds Purvis that Babyface has already driven away from the inn. And although Agent Metcalf called in a license plate number, finding Nelson on the highway might be difficult. Cowley scrambles Special Agents W.C. Ryan and T.M. McDade, pulling them away from a separate investigation with orders to proceed immediately up Highway 12 toward Wisconsin. Purvis phones Washington to apprise Hoover of the situation. The director still thinks unfavorably of Agent Purvis, so it is an aide who receives the briefing about Nelson's new location. The action happens very quickly. The time is 4 p.m. as the black Ford V8 travels southeast on Highway 12 toward Chicago. Babyface and Helen ride up front, with Chase in the back. The road is divided by a grass median. A half mile north of Fox River Grove, Illinois, Special Agents McDade and Ryan spot the stolen Ford, Illinois license plate 639578. They travel 200 yards up the road to a bend, then prepare to make a U-turn and give chase. McDade is fresh out of training school and seeing his first action, but Ryan is a veteran of the Little Bohemia and Biograph Theater shootings. As McDade drives, Ryan unholsters his .38 Super pistol. Nelson suspects he is being followed, so he makes a U-turn of his own and drives straight toward the agents. Minutes pass, and Babyface Nelson pulls alongside agents McDade and Ryan. Without warning, John Paul Chase leans over from the back seat and aims a Browning rifle at the agents. He lets loose a burst, but misses the men. The situation seems hopeless for the G-men. In the reverse of almost any normal situation, it is the criminals who control the highway. McDade and Ryan lack firepower compared to the gangsters, carrying only sidearms. Agent McDade does not pull over. Instead, he steps on the gas, swerving to miss a milk truck while pulling away from Nelson. John Paul Chase opens fire again, hitting the back of the federal vehicle from close range, but not striking either agent. McDade and Ryan drive with their heads low for 300 yards before Ryan turns and fires 7 shots at Nelson's car. One bullet pierces the Ford's radiator. Babyface nurses the Ford down the highway. McDade and Ryan pull ahead, then stop near a field, anticipating the gangster's car. they will wait in vain. For Babyface Nelson exits the highway to avoid this confrontation. Simultaneously, agents Sam Cowley and Ed Hollis arrive on the scene. Hollis was one of the three DOI agents who shot Dillinger and now prepares to take aim at Babyface as well. They watch as Nelson's car leaves the highway at a place known as Park Road. Cowley and Hollis give chase. The disabled Ford comes to a stop as the two agents close in. But before Cowley and Hollis can stop their Hudson sedan, Nelson and Chase are standing on the Ford's running boards, shooting at the agents as Helen presses herself into a ditch to take cover. Nelson fires a machine gun as Chase takes aim with his semi-automatic BAR. Footnote: the Browning Automatic Rifle, or BAR, was originally designed by John Browning in 1917 for use by American troops in World War I. The weapon would go on to see widespread use in World War II and the Korean War. End footnote. Cowley and Hollis are not hit as they swerve to a stop, then use their vehicle as a shield to return fire from a distance of 40 yards. In the 10-minute gun battle that ensues, Special Agents Sam Cowley and Herman Hollis are shot dead. Hollis dies instantly, a bullet from Nelson's machine gun piercing his forehead and exploding out the back of his skull. Cowley, shot several times in the stomach, hangs on for 10 hours before dying at a local hospital. Agent Melvin Purvis, along with Cowley's wife and young son, are at his bedside. In the meantime, Babyface steals the Hudson sedan that the agents were driving. There are bullet holes in the rear of the vehicle and back window. Babyface, Helen, and John Paul Chase drive to the home of a local priest whom they have met several times before. But Father Philip Coughlin refuses to provide them shelter for fear of implicating his sister, who owns the house. So Babyface travels on, arriving at a known safe house in the nearby town of Niles Center. Babyface, Helen, and Chase leave their car shortly after 5 p.m. It is already dark. They enter the small gray stucco home at 1627 Walnut Street without being spotted. Babyface Nelson has gotten away again, or so the Division of Investigation believes. A massive federal manhunt begins immediately. The first break is when the Hudson belonging to Agents Cowley and Hollis is found abandoned in Winnetka, Illinois, its front seat covered in blood. Immediately after arriving at the safe house, Helen cuts off Nelson's blood-soaked clothing to treat his wounds, but she is too late. The gangster dies at 7:35 p.m. By then, Chase had fled with the stolen Hudson, leaving the couple to their fates. It is 1:30 a.m. when the owner of the safe house insists they dump the body. Babyface Nelson's naked corpse is wrapped in a red, green, and black Navajo Indian blanket, loaded into an Oldsmobile, and driven to the edge of town by Helen and the owner of the safe house. It is then dropped outside St. Paul's Cemetery. Helen insists he be laid upon the grass near the gate instead of on pavement. Before leaving, she tucks the blanket tightly around her husband to keep him warm. "I wanted Les to be comfortable," Helen will later testify. "He always hated the cold." That morning, an undertaker at the Sadowski Funeral Home in the town of Niles Center receives an anonymous phone call directing him to a corpse dumped outside St. Paul's Cemetery. The body is naked. Buckshot wounds speckle both legs, and a machine gun round has torn open the abdomen. It is a gruesome sight. The corpse is that of Babyface Nelson. Helen is then driven to the north side of Chicago, where she wanders the streets for 2 days. The newspaper headlines scream that she is America's first female public enemy, and J. Edgar Hoover issues an order to find the woman and give no quarter. In the end, she turns herself in. Helen is later convicted of violating her parole agreement from the Little Bohemia shootings. She serves 1 year and a day at the Women's Correctional Farm in Milan, Michigan, but faces no other legal charges. When asked why she went along with her husband's wicked ways, Helen answers, "I loved Les. When you love a guy, you love him. That's all there is to it." Helen Gillis never remarries. Later in life, she goes by the name Helen Nelson. After the anonymous phone call concerning the location of Babyface's corpse, the body is transported to the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office in Chicago, the same place John Dillinger was taken. The public is allowed to file past during a public viewing. On December 1, 1934, the 26-year-old Lester Gillis is laid to rest at the St. Joseph Cemetery in River Grove, where he is buried next to his father. 200 people attend the funeral. The 6 pallbearers are all men with known connections to the Chicago underworld. There is no eulogy, no priest, and no music. The only sound is that of Babyface Nelson's crying mother. Footnote: Helen Gillis and Mary Gillis would later be buried alongside Babyface. End footnote. Almost immediately, J. Edgar Hoover sets up another confrontation. The new public enemy number one is a kidnapper, bank robber, and murderer named Alvin Karpis. The 27-year-old creepy Karpis is Canadian-born and possesses a photographic memory. He describes his profession as robbing banks, knocking off payrolls, and kidnapping rich men. Karpis has aligned himself with a family of criminals known as the Barkers, consisting of the brothers Doc and Fred, and their mother Kate, simply known as Ma. Together, the Karpis-Barker gang have terrorized much of the Midwest. Karpis's whereabouts are currently unknown, but Hoover feels that his capture or killing should not take long. Karpis had plastic surgery in March 1934, along with a procedure to burn off his fingerprints. Both operations were unsuccessful, meaning that his appearance is not only easily recognizable, but also portrayed on wanted posters splashed across the United States. But if the pursuit of Alvin Karpis feels different to Hoover from that of previous public enemy number ones, it is because none other than President Franklin D. Roosevelt has begun a personal involvement in the case. On January 17, 1934, Edward George Bremer of St. Paul, Minnesota, is kidnapped at gunpoint by the Karpis-Barker gang. The ransom is set at $200,000, $3,826,776 in modern money. Bremer is a prominent local financier, chairman of the American National Bank, and also manager of the Homeowners Loan Corporation. In the eyes of the public, the dark-haired Bremer is a villain, the sort of banker embodying the foreclosures and repossessions so common in America during the Great Depression. The gangsters who slid inside the banker's Lincoln Continental at a crosswalk, guns drawn, just seconds after he dropped his 9-year-old daughter Hertzie off at her private school, are making such men know the same pain countless families across the country now feel. In fact, Bremer is known to be selfish and possess a volatile temper. A DOI report on his character will state that he is very much disliked, not only by his family, but generally. Bremer fights back ferociously and almost manages to escape while being abducted, but is struck repeatedly over the head with a handgun after his car is hijacked, then pushed to the floor. Goggles are placed over his eyes. Bremer leaves behind so much blood from his pistol whipping that investigators will doubt his survival. If Edward Bremer were just another banker, the crime might not have made national headlines. But Bremer is also the son of Adolf Bremer, owner of the Jacob Schmidt Brewing Company. The older Bremer is a major campaign contributor to President Roosevelt's upcoming 1936 re-election campaign and is considered such a valuable supporter that his company will soon receive an exclusive contract to provide beer to the United States Army. Upon receiving word of the kidnapping, a sympathetic Roosevelt speaks publicly about Bremer's abduction, calling it an attack on all we hold dear. Hoover's agents are unable to find a single clue to Bremer's whereabouts, and the family soon pays the ransom, using marked bills provided by the DOI. On February 7th, 3 weeks after the kidnapping, Edward Bremer is released. Of course, the manhunt continues. Using details provided by Bremer, as well as discovering key fingerprints that place the Carpus Barker gang at the scene of the crime, the DOI arrests Doc Barker, who is eventually sentenced to life in prison. On January 8, 1935, Fred Barker and the notorious Ma Barker, whom many consider the logistical mastermind of the robberies and kidnappings, are shot dead by the DOI at their hideout in Lake Weir, Florida. Footnote: Arthur Doc Barker spent 4 years in Alcatraz, but tried to escape and was shot dead by guards. End footnote. But public enemy number one, Alvin Carpus, remains at large, and J. Edgar Hoover has absolutely no idea where to find him. "Did you ever make an arrest?" the Tennessee senator asks J. Edgar Hoover. The date is April 11, 1936. The last year has been a success for the director, who forced the resignation of Agent Melvin Purvis by falsely accusing him of public drunkenness. And at Hoover's insistence on July 1, 1935, the Division of Investigation was renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation, in hopes that the public will find the name easier to remember. But 15 months have passed since the Bremer kidnapping, and Alvin Carpus is still nowhere to be found. The director is now appearing before the Senate Appropriations Committee, boldly asking that the FBI's annual budget be doubled to $5 million. Hoover has come prepared, armed with charts, graphs, and a deep pile of statistics to buttress his request. But Senator Kenneth McKellar has a deep dislike for Hoover, founded by the director's refusal to hire more men from Tennessee as special agents. In fact, Hoover does quite the opposite by firing three special agents with Tennessee roots shortly after McKellar's request. Now the senator is getting his revenge. As chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, the bellicose McKellar, who wears wire-rimmed glasses and a dark suit, is within his rights to question Hoover in detail. But rather than focus on money, the senator has belittled the director publicly, making Hoover squirm so much that Missouri freshman Senator Harry Truman has even intervened on his behalf, hoping to lighten the line of questioning. But McKellar presses on, demanding to know Hoover's qualifications to lead the FBI. "No, sir," Hoover responds to McKellar's question about making arrests. "I have made investigations." "How many arrests have you made, and who were they?" Hoover deflects, describing the many cases he has managed. "Did you make the arrests?" McKellar demands. "The arrests were made by officers under my supervision." "I am talking about the actual arrests. You never arrested them, actually?" The director does not answer the question. "Here is a man who never captured a criminal in his life, never solved a case in his life," McKellar concludes, his destruction of Hoover complete. The director will remember this day for the rest of his life, though not because the Senate turned down his request for additional appropriation. Instead, it is the public humiliation that remains with him, which Hoover compares with being publicly castrated. And for J. Edgar Hoover, for whom a positive public impression is vital, nothing is more important than his image. So Hoover swings into action. No one can find the handcuffs. Just 2 weeks after J. Edgar's debacle before the Senate, Alvin Carpus has been spotted in New Orleans. Local residents have tipped off the FBI about the gangster's location. Agents confirm this, but rather than make an immediate arrest, the agents place a call to Hoover in Washington. Upon being notified, the director immediately flies south to apprehend the suspect himself. Shortly after 5 p.m. on May 1st, Karpus and an accomplice leave their apartment on Canal Street and step into a Plymouth coupe. Just as Karpus settles into his seat, five special agents surround the car, guns drawn. Hoover steps through the crowd. "Put the cuffs on him, boys," the director says grandly. But no one thought to bring handcuffs. Instead, Alvin Karpus is bound with the necktie of Special Agent Clarence Hurt. The fourth and final federal public enemy number one is now in custody, and Director Hoover finally has an arrest. Alvin Karpus is flown to St. Paul, where he stands trial for kidnapping and is sentenced to life in prison. Karpus is incarcerated at the new Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary in the middle of San Francisco Bay. There he does his time alongside another public enemy number one, Al Capone. The term public enemy was made famous by J. Edgar Hoover, but it was not his idea at all. It was 1930 when the Chicago Crime Commission named Capone the city's public enemy number one. His type of crime was not the robbing of a bank, but a far more complex web of misdeeds ranging from bootlegging to extortion to murder for hire. And unlike bank robbers, Capone does not operate informally. He is part of a larger body of felons seeking to control the criminal enterprises of entire cities. These men go by several names: Mafia, Cosa Nostra, Black Hand, The Organization, or simply, The Mob. And while J. Edgar Hoover believes the demise of Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Babyface Nelson signaled that he has triumphed in the war on crime, the truth is that the mob is far more dangerous than individual gangsters. Which J. Edgar Hoover will soon learn the hard way. Chapter 5. June 23, 1936, Alcatraz Penitentiary, 9:45 a.m. Al Capone lets down his guard. It is shortly after breakfast as the man nicknamed Scarface works his shift, mopping the prison shower room. He once wore expensive suits and diamonds, but now displays the standard Alcatraz uniform of blue chambray shirt, trousers, belt, and shoes. Capone is 37, the former head of a notorious Chicago crime syndicate that earned profits of more than $100 million annually, worth more than $18 billion in modern currency. He lived without fear of arrest, paying off judges, police, and politicians to ensure his freedom. But the mental acuity necessary to oversee a criminal enterprise is now beyond Capone because of a chronic syphilitic infection that is eroding his mind. And while Alphonse Gabriel Capone was once the most feared mob boss in America, reputed to have killed more than 30 human beings, he is now just another inmate at this escape-proof prison on a windy island in the middle of San Francisco Bay. Capone knows he has enemies here at Alcatraz. He has a reputation among the inmates for seeking special treatment from Warden James A. Johnston, who has famously declared that his prisoners are entitled to food, clothing, shelter, and medical attention. Anything else you get is a privilege. This dictum, also known as Rule Number 5 in the Inmate Regulation Handbook, is the reason Warden Johnston constantly denies Capone favors. But that doesn't stop the mob boss from trying. In one instance, he attempts to avoid the wait at the prison barbershop. "Get to the back of the line, you bum," says fellow inmate James Lucas, a 22-year-old Texan known as a chronic hothead. "Do you know who I am, punk?" snarls the thick-set Capone. Lucas grabs a pair of barber shears and presses a blade into Capone's jugular vein. "Yeah, I know who you are, greaseball. and if you don't get back to the end of the line, I'm going to know who you were." The two men, one a bank robber and car thief, the other America's most famous mobster, become mortal enemies after the incident. Capone puts out the word that anyone who kills Lucas will be handsomely rewarded. But it is Lucas who takes action. As Al Capone mops the shower room, the young Texan attacks from behind, slashing at the gangster with scissors. Capone wheels and throws up his hands to defend himself, but blood flows onto the floor as Lucas plunges the scissors into his fellow inmate's back, chest, and palms. Sounds of the fight bring guard Thomas J. Sanders on the run. Beating Lucas severely with his billy club, Sanders puts an end to the murder attempt. James Lucas is quickly sent to D Block and placed in solitary confinement. Al Capone is hustled off to the prison infirmary for treatment of his wounds. He survives, though with a new set of scars to go with the three others cascading so dramatically down his left cheek. 4 years into an 11-year sentence for tax evasion, Capone quickly returns to life as an Alcatraz inmate. At night, like the other prisoners, he is tormented by laughter and partying in the city of San Francisco. The sounds carried across the cold waters of the bay as if the nightlife was right next door. But it is not. San Francisco is over 1 mile away from this island the inmates call The Rock. For Al Capone, it has always been about not keeping his mouth shut. He is 18 and working as a bartender and bouncer at a cabaret in Brooklyn's Coney Island called the Harvard Inn. The young man can be charming, but one evening as he takes a shine to a beautiful patron, he prefers to be crass. "Honey," Capone whispers to a dark-haired woman sitting at a table with another man, "you have a nice ass, and I mean that as a compliment. Believe me." The beauty's name is Lena Galluccio. The other man is her brother. A drunken Frank Galluccio lunges at Capone after hearing the lewd comments. Capone fights back. Galluccio draws a pocket knife and slashes at the young bartender, slicing open the left side of his face. As Frank and Lena hustle from the dance hall to escape further conflict, a dazed and bleeding Capone is rushed to the hospital. Soon after his release, face still covered in stitches, the future mobster goes looking for Galluccio, seeking revenge. As it turns out, both men work for crime families. A meeting is arranged to broker a truce. It is a hoodlum named Charles Lucky Luciano who arranges the sit-down at the Harvard Inn with both men. Al Capone is ordered to apologize for insulting Lena. He is also told not to seek revenge. Capone does not argue the ruling, understanding that he must obey or die. Capone also understands his new nickname, Scarface. This is the way of life within the world of organized crime. The syndicates consider themselves family units, and leaders are sought out for their wisdom in times of conflict. Capone enters this world after dropping out of school at the age of 14. He first belongs to a Brooklyn street gang named the Rippers, who mainly steal cigarettes. But soon, a 25-year-old mobster named Francesco Ioli, a.k.a. Frankie Yale, takes young Capone under his wing. Yale is a criminal visionary, the first gangster to use the term family to describe Italian immigrants who perform acts of racketeering, extortion, and murder. He is not averse to working with local Irish gangs, knowing both will profit despite their ethnic differences. Frankie Yale, who adopted the last name to coincide with the collegiate theme of the Harvard Inn, becomes the main influence in Al Capone's life. In 1920, knowing that he must leave Brooklyn if he is to prosper on his own, a newly married Capone moves to Chicago with Frankie Yale's blessing. Footnote: Al Capone married May Coughlin, an Irish girl from a middle-class family, in 1918. Although he frequently consorted with mistresses and prostitutes, the couple remained married the remainder of Capone's life. They had one child, Albert Francis Capone, who went by the nickname Sonny. End footnote. There, he joins the Colissimo family, along with fellow New York transplant Johnny the Fox Torrio. The Fox is the nephew of Big Jim Colissimo, who controls more than 100 brothels staffed by sex slaves. But Big Jim has a problem. A gang known as the Black Hand, imported from Italy, is making extravagant extortion demands against Colissimo. Big Jim assigns the Fox, known as a brutal enforcer, to put that to an end. At 38, Giovanni Torrio is older than Al Capone by 17 years. Born in southern Italy, he changed his name as a young man to sound more American. Torrio is a natural leader, known for being strategic and cunning. However, within weeks of moving to Chicago, the Fox is clashing with his uncle, Big Jim. Torrio believes that Colissimo's focus on prostitution is limiting. On January 17, 1920, a new law known as the Volstead Act goes into effect. This prohibits the sale or possession of alcohol. Prohibition, as it becomes known, does not at first seem like a new revenue stream for the criminal families, or at least not to Big Jim Colissimo. But the Fox sees it differently. Secretly providing a thirsty American public with alcohol has the potential to reap an enormous amount of wealth. Torrio believes that the crime syndicates are making a grave mistake if they do not participate in the new pastime of bootlegging, in which alcohol is smuggled into the country and made available for sale at highly inflated prices. Footnote: bootlegging is a 19th century term based upon the smuggler's trick of concealing bottles in their boots. End footnote. So it is that Johnny the Fox Torrio resorts to extreme measures. He arranges a business meeting with the Jenna crime family, on the surface an ally of Big Jim. Torrio boldly informs the Jennas of his plans to expand into bootlegging and seeks their permission to murder his uncle. The gangsters, led by six brothers known as the Terrible Jennas, control the Little Italy section of Chicago. Sicilian by birth, they own a federal license to manufacture industrial alcohol. Along with communion wine, this